You're listening to the Seasteading Today podcast, where we speak to entrepreneurs and researchers who are making the dream of seasteading a reality. The Seasteading Today podcast. Stop arguing and start seasteading.
Hello, seasteaders. This is Carly Jackson on the Seasteading Today podcast. My guest today is Neil Anthony Sims, CEO of Kampachi Farms and founder of the Vilela Mariculture Research Project. Neil Sims' fish farms have proven that we don't need to deny human needs in order to protect the environment. We can grow delicious, healthy fish in a way that restores the environment. Sims is dedicated to harnessing the profit motive to counter climate change. Giving people an opportunity to make money and support themselves while reversing the harmful effects of pollution seems to me the only way to be successful. And his Kampachi sounds delicious. Let's get to the interview with Neil Sims. Welcome, Neil.
Thank you, Carly. It's a pleasure.
So the Seasteading book says your mission is to repopulate the ocean with fish. Is that still your mission?
It's a complex question, Carly. I think that humankind has visited all sorts of violence upon the seas, particularly over the last 50, 60 years. And as if originally I was a fisheries biologist trying to manage commercial fisheries, and I'd come to the realization that we weren't going to be able to feed the planet with commercial fisheries, and actually commercial fisheries in and of themselves are highly incentivized to push fish stocks towards extinction, because their job is to go and catch as many fish as they can. The sense of what our mission is now is to be able to alleviate the fishing pressure on the seas by providing sustainable, scalable sources of farmed seafood, and that as that grows to scale, it will, in the same way that as terrestrial agriculture has scaled, it has reduced the hunting pressure on deer and ducks and passenger pigeons. Well, actually, passenger pigeons, we got there too late and they ended up being driven to extinction. But deer and ducks, their populations now thrive and are very well managed, but only for recreational pursuits. And I think that's because we're able to feed this planet with other forms of agriculture, poultry, pork, cattle. And I would see the same transition happening on the oceans over the next 50 to 100 years. And so in a circumlocuous fashion, yes, we do look to repopulate the seas, but it's through the promoting production of development of more efficient means of production. And it's not just limited to fish production as well. Early in my career, I'd worked extensively in pearl oysters, and we'd still, I think that bivalves are ecologically bountiful. They bring many benefits to the environment. And we're also working on offshore seaweed production systems, because seaweeds have the potential to produce both foods for humans, feeds for animal, and fuels as an alternative to the carcasses of creatures that died millennia ago.
So let's review some of the stuff that was described in the Seasteading book. With your Kampachi Farms, you took a wild fish called kahala, and this kahala are thrown back by fishermen, but you found a way to grow them into healthy and environmentally restorative ways. Is that right?
Yes, but also very delicious ways as well, by farming what was called kahala in the wild, and we call them kona kampachi here, and our Mexican farm is now producing what we brand as king kampachi. But by farming this fish, we're able to convert what's a good tasting fish into a phenomenal species, one that has been championed by Graham Keller from the French Laundry and Morimoto from the Iron Chef, and Paul Greenberg, who wrote the definitive book for fish on aquaculture. And so it's not just an environmentally sound way to produce seafood, it's also a way to produce great tasting seafood. And that, from an environmental perspective, that's important because Lord knows we desperately need to increase the consumption of seafood from both an environmental perspective and from a consumer health perspective.
Yes, so why, can you say more about that consumer health perspective? Why is fish beneficial?
The science that's been done from a public health perspective has said that Americans should be at least doubling their consumption of oily fish. That consumption is around 14 pounds per year. And the underconsumption of seafood leads to all sorts of health problems, because seafood is critical. The omega-3 fatty acids are really beneficial for heart health and for brain health. And the consumption of terrestrial animals, particularly pork and beef, it has issues for heart health and cardiovascular health that could be alleviated by more seafood consumption.
Did you have any prejudice to overcome when you like, if you were selling your fish to restaurants and chefs, what sort of convincing did you have to do to convince them that your fish was good?
All we have to do is get a sample of it on their palate, Carly. And and then they go weak at the knees and a little unsteady, and their eyes roll back a bit and they tip their head back and they go, wow, that's about the best fish I've ever tasted. And that's pretty much a universal response, that this Campachi is a phenomenal species and we're really proud to be able to grow it in a way that meets the most rigorous, most exacting environmental and social certification standards.
What's your favorite recipe of Campachi? How do you like to eat it?
Just straight raw. As a sashimi product, it is phenomenal. It also cooks up really well. Just a light sear in the pan with perhaps a little bit of butter. That's the fish speaks for itself. It's a phenomenal, phenomenal product. Carly, have you not had any Campachi? We're sitting here talking about this.
I have not. Where can I find it? I live in Texas.
Actually, HEB supermarkets used to carry, I'm not sure if they still do, but they used to carry our product. There's a number of places across Texas. I can connect you with our seafood distributors that can then connect you to the restaurants. The seafood distribution pipeline is very complex, but it's very efficient. You think that to be able to get fish from Hawaii or from Mexico to a restaurant or to a retail outlet in Texas, it's a long way to move fish in a very short period of time.
And where can people in other parts of the United States find Campachi?
If you go to usually very high-end sushi restaurants, will carry it. Or it's in a number of other white tablecloth restaurants.
All right.
The problem, why I can't be more definitive about that, we've just started production out of Mexico with the King Campachi coming out of Mexico. But our production volumes there are still relatively small, and production out of Hawaii is relatively small. We really need to scale production of this species. It should be in every seafood counter, in every supermarket across the country. It should be, our goal is ultimately to have this fish in the individual quick frozen pouches in the bag in Costco all across America.
So let's talk about the farms and how they started and then get into how you want to scale up. So it started, you have this this fish cage, and you found a place in Hawaii where the eddies made kept the water flowing, where you can put your cage and the fish can keep swimming and the water flows. So can you explain a bit about that and why that was a desirable location to start with your farms?
Right. The commercial farm here in Hawaii, we need to differentiate between the initial seasteading book had spoken a lot about our Valala project, which was the unanchored drifter cage project that we had tested out the idea of a cage with no anchor, drifted around in the back of the Big Island for 8 months. We're not completely crazy. We did have it attached to a boat at the time because we needed to be feeding the fish twice a day, three times a day, and we needed to be tending to it. So you need to be tethered to it. And that demonstration project, the Valala beta test, and then the subsequent Valala gamma test, which was where we had the same pen, very small scale, again, only 2,000 fish, but we brought it in within 6 miles of shore in 6,000 feet of water and dropped an anchor down. In water that deep, you need about 12,000 feet of mooring line. The cage itself was still up very close to the surface. It's a submersible cage, but we could bring it to the surface when and as we needed it. And we ran that project completely by remote control. We would only have to go out once a week to top up the feed in the hopper and to top up the fuel in the generator. And the rest of it was run through the cloud from an iPhone or an iPad, wherever. I mean, I had my research manager feeding the fish, literally feeding the fish from his iPhone when we were sitting down together in the Seattle Conference Center with a bunch of excited aquaculturists leaning over our shoulders as Gavin is sitting there switching on the video and watching the fish underwater and the boats, the surface video of the boats for security, and then switching on the generator and the pumps and the auger to be feeding the fish. You can do all of this. This was all pretty much off-the-shelf technology to be able to run this remotely. But that's all the research work that we've been doing. We continue that research work. We have a demonstration pen that we are proposing. We're going through the permit process at the moment that will be around 40 miles offshore in the Gulf of Mexico, offshore from Florida. We need to be out that deep, that far offshore so that we can be in deep enough waters. It's only about 130 feet deep when you're 40 miles offshore. It's a very, very broad shelf on the west coast of Florida. But we will continue that Valala demonstration work. The goal of the Valala project in the Gulf of Mexico is to be able to demonstrate to the commercial and recreational and charter boat fishing communities that offshore aquaculture can be a real boon for fishing. That whilst fishermen are often very fearful of any aquaculture because they see it as being competitive, when you put a fish pen out offshore, it becomes a phenomenal fish aggregating device, or FAD, FAD. And the FAD for fishermen, instead of them having to wander around all over the ocean looking for where the fish are, they can go straight to the FAD. And if there are pelagic fish such as tuna or mahi-mahi or wahoo or marlin, more than likely they will be around the FAD. So the original Valala projects that we'd had here in Hawaii, the local fishing community was ecstatic. I had fishermen coming up to me in the harbour here in Kona and grabbing me by the metaphorical lapels and saying, please don't take that fish pen out. That's the best fishing I've had in my life.
So these wild fish were attracted to your fish pens?
Yes, but wild fish will generally be attracted to anything. A FAD could be just a simple bamboo raft or a buoy just by itself. When it's something with other fish in it, like a fish pen, it seems to work phenomenally well. And so our goal in the Gulf of Mexico with what we're calling the Valala Epsilon, if you're following us here, we're working our way through the Greek alphabet, is to be able to help the fishing community in Florida understand the bountiful benefits of offshore aquaculture for fishing. And we think that there's a great synergy that can happen between offshore aquaculture and recreational and commercial fishing.
So the current version of the cages, do you still have to travel out once a week to fill the fish pens or the bins for food?
when we are in offshore in Sarasota, we'll be 40 miles offshore, and you can't do a Wi-Fi bridge over that sort of a distance. We've attempted in the past to do this through satellite communication in the Vilela beta test. The original plan there was to have that all through satellite connections, but that was very expensive, breathtakingly expensive, and it was also very difficult to do. It's hard to push that much data through a satellite unless you're part of the military-industrial complex, and then it's you can fly a drone around the hills of Afghanistan when you're sitting in a comfortable chair in Langley, Virginia. But if you're just in the commercial business, satellites are really expensive and really difficult to communicate. And so in Sarasota, we are moving more towards the seasteading model of having people living out on the farm site. And so we will have a crew out there 24/7 for the full grow-out cycle. And we're expecting it to be a 10 to 12-month grow-out cycle in Sarasota. There are a number of commercial projects that spring from our offshore aquaculture development work. The farm in Kona, Hawaii, is still operating and producing their Hawaiian kampachi here. They did about 500 tons, 600 tons last year. We have started up commercial production from the farm site in La Paz that is 4 miles out offshore in the Sea of Cortez. That operation there is that should be producing 500 tons in its first year, but we have plans to expand that up over 2,000 tons over the next 3 to 4 years. And then there's another company, I mentioned Lockheed Martin earlier. They had been partners with us in the Vilela beta test and Vilela gamma test here in Kona, and they have spun off that crew into a company called Forever Oceans, which is also working here in Kona to continue with the unmanned offshore farm site development. They have a demonstration net pen that's 8 miles out offshore here in Kona that they run through a wireless bridge. So there's also a lot of research work and research scale-up. Sorry, there's a lot of commercial work and commercial scale-up that is springing from the research work.
That sounds fantastic. So I would like to backtrack a bit. Will you describe for those of us who haven't read the seasteading book what the innovation is in your cages that changes your farms from traditional fish farming?
I think the fundamental guiding principle, Carly, is that we think about further, deeper. That's our mantra. We keep saying to ourselves we want to be further offshore and we want to be in deeper water because that allows us to scale. And if we're going to grow seafood production the way that we have to feed 9 billion people on this planet, because Lord knows we cannot feed them with beef. There's simply not enough land area to grow that many cows. There's not enough fresh water to supply those cows. And the greenhouse gas emissions from terrestrial land animals are really significant. The impacts on the atmosphere from primarily the methane and the nitrous oxide are significant contributors to greenhouse gases. And so we need to grow, need to expand marine fish production. And we, up until this point, most of the marine fish production has been close to shore because that's what the engineering has allowed us to do. But we believe that as you move further offshore towards the horizon, deeper water, you have more of a disconnect between what's in the cage and the substrate underneath the pens. And this then, you have, by doing this, you reach a point where you have minimal, almost immeasurable impact on the environment. Almost no measurable impact on the water quality. You can't tell the difference in water quality from up current of the cage and down current of the cage. And almost no measurable impact, or certainly no significant impact on the substrate, the sand or the rock that's immediately beneath the pens and in the down current side of the pens.
So by
being able to do this with no significant ecological impact, that then allows you to scale production.
And wasn't your Villela project like upstream from some tourist diving area?
No, but we did have tourists coming out and diving on the drifter pen and then the Villela beta test, and then also on the gamma test where it was moored, and so people knew where it was. It moved around in like a 5 mile diameter watch circle as the currents changed, but they knew generally where it was, and you could easily find it because there'd be a cluster of fishing boats around it whenever. Because of the FAD effects that I've mentioned earlier. And so there were recreational and commercial dive tour operators that would take people out and dive on these pens. And it really was a spectacular sight because you'd be in the water, in this perfectly blue water all around 360 degrees, and there would be swirling bait fish and tuna and wahoo and mahi-mahi. It was really it's an oasis in the middle of the desert, because here in the tropics, once you get away from shore, the oceans are essentially a desert.
And we've talked about that in other interviews, the fact that you have all of these nutrients at the bottom of the ocean and you need to bring them up where photosynthesis can occur. So you've done some work with cultivating algae. Are you still working on that, or have the Kampachi fish taken all of your time?
No, as a matter of fact, we're refocusing some work here to provide more focus on the offshore macroalgae culture. Macroalgae is a technical word for seaweed, so I'll use those interchangeably here. But we are going through the permit process for a test array, a demonstration array for offshore macroalgae culture that will be located just a mile and a half out offshore from the Kona coast. It will have a pipe that will go down to around 100 meters depth, and that will be driven by wave energy, so there will be no energy requirements to pump the deep sea water at all. It will just work on wave energy. And even here in the Kona coast, where it is very calm waters most of the time, there'll be enough wave energy to move the water that will provide the nutrients for these native Hawaiian algae that we'll be culturing. And the funding for that demonstration project is primarily provided from ARPA-E, the Advanced Research Projects Agency for Energy, under the Department of Energy. But we are looking initially, we'll be looking to commercialize products for food, for human food and for feed. The human food, there's a number of Hawaiian algae species that are eaten already by Hawaiians and that are also an important part of traditional poke recipes. Poke is taking America by storm.
Yes, I've noticed.
There are almost as many poke stores as there are Starbucks now, and that's a good thing. That's a good thing. But there are some of the algaes that are cultured could be used in poke, or Americans should be eating more seafood as well. There are a lot of indications that seafood can be very beneficial for human diets. And we're also looking at using the macroalgae, the seaweed that we would grow in this demonstration array, as feed for herbivorous fish. We've been conducting a number of trials with rudderfish, or chubs, as they are called on the east coast of America. And we have developed ways to culture these fish in the hatchery. Although they are the same as the wild kahala here, which we've turned into the Kampachi, now a culinary phenomenon, chubs as well are fairly derided in the wild because they eat seaweed, so they have a strong seaweed flavor. but you are what you eat. And so we think that there are ways that we could be feeding these fish seaweed and then finishing them off on a tilapia diet or a snapper diet. We think of the chubs as a fish that you could probably feed them a tilapia diet and they taste as good as a snapper. But we view macroalgae as a feedstock for the rudder fish, for the chubs, that's a much more economical way to culture the feed, because macroalgae don't need any land area, they don't need any fresh water, and if the deep seawater upwelling works, well, they don't need any fertilizer. And if we can figure out how to culture them, these seaweeds in the open ocean, then there is tremendous ability to scale this. I'd mentioned earlier the ecological benefits of this, if I can just highlight those, because I think it's important when we're thinking about the permitting process of scaling production like this. There are a lot of benefits, ecological benefits, just in terms of the primary productivity and then the secondary productivity that comes around. If you have seaweed grown offshore, it's going to be a phenomenal oasis for other forms of marine life. But then, because photosynthesis uses nutrients and carbon dioxide and sunlight to produce, to go through the photosynthetic process, that if you have offshore seaweed culture systems in areas where you have high nutrient flow, perhaps such as the dead zone that occurs down near the Gulf of Mexico, that you could be absorbing a number of the excess nutrients that are in the ocean. And because photosynthesis also pulls carbon dioxide inland, it pulls it out of the atmosphere, and in the ocean it pulls carbon dioxide out of the seawater. And carbon dioxide is the primary driver for ocean acidification. If you're not worried about ocean acidification, if you are not lying awake at night staring at the ceiling, sweating about the catastrophic impacts of ocean acidification on ocean ecosystems, you're not paying enough attention, because the people do a lot of hand-wringing about whether the modeling of global climate change, whether it's real or not, how accurate the models are, and whether it's human-caused. And there's a lot of variables that go into those models. Nobody argues about the modeling for ocean acidification, because it is a simple equilibrium equation of how much carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere converts into how much carbon dioxide there is in the ocean, and carbon dioxide drives the pH of the ocean down so that it becomes less basic and more acidic. And that has horrendous impacts on any animal that has a calcareous shell in the ocean, and that is all of your coral, all of your bivalves, all of your crustaceans. And if you're talking about the acidification impacts on internal skeletons, then all of the fish. So a large proportion of the ocean's biota, the living animals in the ocean, are highly susceptible to changes in pH, to reductions in pH. And so it's clearly human-driven, and if we cannot find a solution for this, there is going to be a mass extinction event in the oceans like the Earth hasn't seen since the Permian-Triassic extinction event, which is a long time ago. I see offshore macroalgae culture, and we as a team here in Kampachi Farms, we see offshore macroalgae culture as the only way that we can harness entrepreneurial incentives and entrepreneurial initiatives, essentially harness the profit motive to counter ocean acidification. All of the other potential solutions to ocean acidification that people talk about are going to require somebody somewhere to pay for them. And so they clearly aren't scalable, because it is, as with global climate change, it is a collective problem that requires collective action, and that's really difficult to do on a global scale. if you can find a way to culture macroalgae, seaweeds, offshore at scale and make money off it, then your challenge then is going to be, how do you control the growth of this industry and how do you minimize the potential impact of this industry? And that's going to be a wonderful problem to have, because that will mean that we actually can start to think about how we can address ocean acidification through removal of carbon dioxide using macroalgae, using seaweeds.
Mm-hmm. So where would you like to see the seasteading movement going in order to work alongside the growth of your kind of fish farming?
I think there's still a lot of fundamental research that needs to happen to allow offshore aquaculture to fulfill the seasteading mission of sustaining permanent inhabitants in offshore communities. But we are getting close and we're moving closer. In Norway, they are now launching offshore aquaculture systems for farming salmon that look like oil rigs. They're about the size and similar design as an oil rig, and these will be manned 24/7. They're being launched out onto the North Sea, and this is as a commercial venture, not as an experiment. And so there's going to be a transition from the current nearshore aquaculture culture systems to offshore aquaculture systems that are run for profit and that are manned by specialist professionals that are out there temporarily. They'll be out for a couple of weeks at a time and then they'll be back on shore for a couple of weeks. But eventually, as we pursue this, there's going to be opportunity for these sorts of culture systems to be providing a platform for economic activity that would support permanent residents. And so that's a long-term goal. That's 20, 30, 50-year time frame. But the fundamental research and development has to happen now, and it should be focused on the technologies that can allow these integrated productivity systems of growing algae, bivalves, herbivorous reef fish, and the so-called carnivorous fish, the high-value fish such as kapachi, ways of growing those fish either in integrated fashion or in these somewhat separated manner, but where there are benefits for each of the different culture systems from the other culture systems as well. For example, you might have macroalgae culture systems that are downcurrent from a kapachi farm system, and then downcurrent of the macroalgae, you might have the rudder fish or chub culture system. So you can then be feeding the seaweed to the rudder fish and the chubs, and downcurrent of those, you might have bivalves that are able to take advantage of the nutrients. These need not necessarily be all the same operation. They could be separate companies, in the same way that in agriculture you can have a poultry farmer that provides in the waste stream from that poultry farm to an organic vegetable farmer, and the organic vegetable farmer then might be providing the water that drains off that organic farm might go into a pond where there is a fish farming system or a crawfish culture. Mm-hmm. And so there's ways to integrate this. It doesn't necessarily have to be a single company, single operation that integrates all of those systems, but there's ways for them to work in an integrated but desegregated fashion.
Well, to wrap up our conversation, how can people find you? Do you have a website or anything to promote?
Certainly, they could reach me through the kapachifarm.com website. That's K-A-M for Michael, P-A-C-H-I-F-A-R-M.com. And that's Neil, N-E-I-L, like Neil Armstrong, Neil Young.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
The Seasteading Today podcast is produced by John Bush. Your host is Carly Jackson. Send feedback and questions to podcast@seasteading.org. To support the podcast and the Seasteading mission, go to seasteading.org/donate. If you'd like to learn more, read the book, Seasteading: How Floating Nations Will Restore the Environment, Enrich the Poor, Cure the Sick, and Liberate Humanity from Politicians. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast feed, and we'll save you a spot on a seastead.